meaning we need to keep oil and gas in the ground.
And we're going to continue this discussion in part two and put it online at democracynow.org. Nick Estes, assistant professor of American Studies at University of New Mexico, author of the new book, Our History is the Future. And that does it for our broadcast. I'll be speaking at SUNY Purchase this weekend, Sunday at 1:30. Check democracynow.org. A very happy birthday to Miriam Barnard. And Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a full-time junior systems administrator here in our New York City studio. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Shea, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump, every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature banned offshore oil exploration this week.
Robert Mueller has delivered his report on President Donald Trump's alleged collusion with the Russian government. Now the question is, how much of it will we get to see?
And Amsterdam is banning tours of the red light district.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 22nd, 2019. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterland. Over 100 students walked out of class this morning at Portland's Benson Polytechnic High School. The students were protesting pending cuts to programs that would hurt juniors and seniors. Unlike traditional high schools, Benson has career and technical education majors that allow for concentrated studies in a student's junior and senior year. Earlier this week, students were told that the architecture major is being eliminated and that other programs were at risk. Harry Esteve, a spokesman for the Portland Public Schools, said the program was not being cut due to funding, but to declining enrollment. He said that only 9 juniors and 9 seniors were signed up for the 2019-2020 school year. Although many of those who walked out were not in the architecture program, they wanted to demonstrate their support for students whose major had been cut. They're asking that the curriculum be maintained for at least one more year so that juniors in the program can graduate with the degree that they've been working towards. Students were advised that other majors may be at risk, but at this point there's no indication of which ones they are.
We often focus on threats to the forest environment, but news this week that the Oregon State Legislature effectively banned offshore oil exploration puts a spotlight on the fragility of the Pacific itself. On what will be the 30th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska, the legislative vote was historic. KBOO's Lisa Loving caught up with Ben Etignap of Oceana for a chat about what the legislature's move means.
Yeah, just this week, the Oregon legislature passed a bill called Senate Bill 256 that prohibits drilling for oil and gas off the Oregon coast, as well as prohibiting any infrastructure that would facilitate oil and gas drilling in federally managed waters further offshore. And really, what led to this was in January of 2018, the Trump administration released a draft Outer Continental Shelf oil and gas leasing program, and it is unlike any draft oil and gas leasing program ever seen before. in that it would consider allowing oil and gas lease sales in nearly 90% of all U.S. ocean waters, including having lease sales for oil and gas drilling off the coast of Washington and Oregon starting in January of 2021. That plan has sparked a real blowback from communities and from states across the country. And people are rising up, including here in Oregon, and saying, we don't want drilling off of our coast, not now and not ever.
If there was oil drilling off the Oregon coast, how would that impact the state? I mean, can you just talk about that?
Well, it's estimated that there are about 400 million barrels of oil off the coast of Washington and Oregon. So it is out there, but it's not as large of estimates as, say, for example, off Southern California, where there is some current oil drilling happening now. But what we know about oil and gas drilling and exploration and the activities associated with that, like shipping, is that eventually there's going to be a leak or a major disaster. And when there are oil spills, when they do happen, it can be devastating to the marine environment and to coastal communities. Many people will remember the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound. Well, we're actually approaching the 30-year anniversary of that massive spill. This Sunday will be the 30-year anniversary. And the effects were dire for the entire ecosystem, and some marine wildlife species have never really recovered. And that is very likely what would happen with a big spill off of our coast. Our fisheries would likely get shut down, and then some of our endangered species like salmon and orcas might not make it. It could be the straw that breaks their back and prevents their recovery.
Ben, who in the Oregon State Legislature supported your work on this oil drilling ban, and who opposed it?
So we're really happy with the Oregon Legislature in passing this bill. This bill was led by Senator Arne Roblin. He's a coastal senator, and Representatives David Gomberg and David Brock Smith, who are also coastal representatives. It was a bipartisan piece of legislation, and it had about 20 additional sponsors of people who joined the bill to want to make sure that it passed. They were true champions for this legislation, and the senators and representatives quickly moved it through committees and to the Senate floor and House floor for passage. So when it passed the Senate 23-6 last month, and then this week it passed the House 47-8.
Tell us about your organization.
Oceana is an international ocean conservation group that's dedicated to protecting the world's oceans. What I normally do when I'm not fighting offshore oil and gas drilling, which is really a new facet of my work, because it wasn't until last year that we really had this big threat from the Trump administration. So normally what we're doing here on the West Coast is protecting seafloor habitats like deep sea corals and sponges that are found off the coast of Oregon. We have gone out and done research expeditions off the Oregon coast, diving with remotely operated vehicles to the nearshore reefs and far offshore banks to identify and really discover the marine life that's out there. There's so much of our ocean that's not been explored, and we don't really know what's out there yet. So we go out there with high definition cameras and document the living seafloor habitats, and then design proposals to protect them. And we work to advance sustainable fisheries and making sure that, you know, we're taking an approach to fishery management that accounts for the role of these fish populations in a wild ocean ecosystem. I mean, our oceans are facing major changes from climate change and ocean acidification to the demands of an increasing human population. And what Oceana is doing is trying to find a way, a bridge to the future, so that we can have sustainable oceans and a future of healthy oceans for the next generation, for the next generations.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The House Energy and Commerce Committee Subcommittee on Communications and Technology is expected to hold a markup and vote to move out of committee the Save the Internet Act, or H.R. 1644. They want to do it as soon as next week. Internet activists are planning an online protest starting Monday with the intention of making a live stream of what would otherwise be a relatively obscure procedural vote and have it go viral to show lawmakers on the committee, quote, "the whole internet is watching," end quote. The Save the Internet Act is the only real net neutrality legislation in play this Congress, but telecom lobbyists have been pushing hard for the committee to gut the bill with hostile amendments that create massive loopholes for internet service providers to abuse, making this subcommittee markup vote perhaps the most important hurdle for the bill to clear. Corporate-friendly Democrats in California attempted a similar ploy to gut their state net neutrality bill, SB 822, but were forced to change course after the move generated massive backlash. The group Fight for the Future stated that politicians seem to still be under the false impression that they can put the interests of giant telecom companies ahead of the basic rights of their constituents and get away with it.
Late yesterday, the Oregon Department of Human Services announced that it had suffered a data breach in January. The DHS is responsible for managing foster care, food stamp, and welfare programs for the state's residents. The breach occurred because 9 of the department's employees clicked on phishing emails that exposed their state email accounts to hackers. In response, the DHS hired the identity protection firm ID Experts to perform a review to determine what information and identities had been exposed. In a statement, the agency said that information that may have been exposed included first and last names, addresses, dates of birth, social security numbers, case number, and other information used to administer DHS programs. The statement went on to say that it didn't appear that any personal information had been compromised, but that ID Experts would contact any affected individuals and credit monitoring services would be made available. The DHS announced the breach to news media because state law requires any entity that suffers a data breach to notify people who may be affected by the most expeditious means available.
Up next, KBOO reporter Leslie McLam comments on several recently released reports about the Portland Police Bureau.
According to a recent report by the City Budget Office, the Portland Police Bureau currently has 75 vacancies, and the number of officers patrolling the city was around 350 last year, with about 50 officers set to retire within months. The report also mentions that the average response time for most urgent calls is still at around 9 minutes, the same as in 2014. In an effort to entice recruitment, there has even been a salary increase of about $17,000 since 2014. Mayor and Police Commissioner Ted Wheeler wants to expand the pool of applicants by reaching out to communities of color, recent immigrants to the United States, and women. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty would prefer to reduce the workload on officers by having non-emergency 911 calls directed to other first responders, including mental health professionals. By ensuring that non-emergency 911 get redirected to more suitable resources, such as health professionals, it could effectively reduce the number of officers needed for patrolling and allow them to focus on more dangerous situations. Police could also potentially reduce response times and the amount of negative interactions with communities which have historically had issue when engaging with police. A separate report by the Portland Police, released on Tuesday, called the Strategic Insights Report, states that 85% of respondents from the community who are Black or African American only trust the police somewhat, a little, or not at all. That would leave only 15% of those respondents having a fair amount of trust in police and their activities. The Strategic Insights Report took community input from 3,100 respondents, data gathered from meetings with stakeholders, focus groups, public meetings, and some input from pre-existing Portland Police Bureau surveys. The stated purpose of the Strategic Insight Report is, quote, "to assess the perception of policing in Portland and to provide guidance in developing the Bureau's 5-year strategic plan, according to the police's press release. Portland Police Chief Danielle Outlaw says, quote, "The Strategic Insights Report is not the strategic plan, but a tool to help us guide in the development of a plan. Thank you to all the community members and Bureau members who shared their perceptions and feedback with us. Some of this information demonstrates to us that we need to do a better job communicating what we do and why we do it," end quote.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rise Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather, rainy and cool, temperatures around 43 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, highs near 57 degrees and mostly cloudy. Today in history, in 1990, a jury in Anchorage, Alaska, finds Captain Joseph Hazelwood not guilty in the Valdez oil spill, even though he and his crew members had been drinking before the oil tanker ran aground. The Exxon Valdez was one of the largest environmental disasters in American history. It dumped more than a million barrels of oil in Prince William Sound and resulted in the deaths of a 250,000 seabirds, thousands of sea otters and seals, hundreds of bald eagles, and uncounted number of salmon and salmon eggs. Sunday is the 30th anniversary of the spill itself. The quote of the day is from Murray Bookchin, who said, "We tend to think of environmental catastrophes such as the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster in the Bay of Alaska as quote-unquote accidents, isolated phenomena that erupt without notice or warning. But when does the word accident become inappropriate? When are such occurrences inevitable rather than accidental? And when does a consistent pattern of inevitable disasters point to a deep-seated crisis that is not only environmental, but profoundly social?"
Earlier this week, the Portland Sustainability Commission voted 5-4 to recommend the residential infill project to City Council. Mayor Wheeler's controversial plan, known by the acronym RIP, would open up nearly all of Portland's residential neighborhoods to demolition and redevelopment. KBOO's Joe Meyer is covering Portland housing and filed this report.
The rollout of Mayor Wheeler's residential infill project has been long and contentious. 2 weeks ago, the Oregonian reported that city planners were cooking the books, presenting one set of numbers when discussing new housing opportunities and a different set of numbers when seeking to hide displacement risk. Furthermore, Mayor Wheeler's planners misled the public about where the development and where the displacement would likely occur. Nonetheless, the Portland Sustainability Commission voted 5-4, largely along real estate developer lines, to recommend the residential infill project to City Council. Andre Bao is a member of Portland's Planning and Sustainability Commission and had this to say when casting his no vote.
We at the city, through the comp plan, took a look, and we knew that East Portland was at risk. There's no surprises there. We had, back in 08, 09, the BLI showed that there was going to be a displacement risk. We created, and I say we, the commission created, along with the housing groups, 11 strategies. Some of those strategies we thought would never happen, rent control, but we threw it in there. It happened. Displacement is not a surprise and should not be a surprise to anybody here. The surprise to me is that we're unwilling to do anything about it. RIP does not address 30-80%. We knew that was the risk going in, so we knew the risk going in, and we're unwilling to take the courage to do something about it. We are a city that has embraced equity in the Portland plan, have gone through, and part of the issue that I had with the letter around this issue of anti-displacement improvement plan is we're going to displace people. And as Eli has said, yeah, there's people being displaced. There is a connection between diversity in a neighborhood and the businesses in those neighborhoods. And as we displaced, they could go to East Portland, but there's nowhere to go. You cannot buy. Who's going to rent to a person that's at 50% of their income? As a business person, you're going to take the best credit risk, and that's 30%. You're not taking someone at 50%. And so this anti-displacement plan seems like a feel-good measure to me, because RIP is displacement, and now the mayor says, or well, not the mayor, but we want the mayor and council to look at implementing an anti-displacement plan. Well, what are you going to do about RIP? If people are leaving, we're just, why don't we spend money there? Let's not spend money on this. And so it's kind of an oxymoron to me that you want to spend money on this and not put money into fixing RIP. We are considered one of the whitest cities in Portland, and I think RIP really becomes, as I said before, institutional racism to create the whitest city in Portland. And you know, the 5 years that I proposed was just an opportunity to give us a break to say, how do we really respond as a city and recognize the value of people in this economic class. It's not only minorities, but it's low income, it's working people, you know, that are going to serve your coffee tomorrow and your dinner tonight, that you can now say, these are, Portland's not for you. And unfortunately, Portland's the wealthiest city. So where they go, there's less services, there's less things. And those cities are faced with greater challenges that they have to go to. And that's the disappointment, that we are not willing to step up to that challenge. I think there is also a fair housing issue here. I think if you dig deep enough into the displacement, I do disparity studies. There is disparity here in the Fair Housing Act, and I think Portland's going to run into that, hopefully. Anything just to slow that. I'm not against volume, but volume's sake, at the end of the day, that creates housing 20, 30 years, 40 years down the road that has fallen apart and that people can fit into in an income level in 80%. Seems like Portland's suggesting we want to get into the slum business. That's how slums are built. We're not in that business. And we need to take pride in holding everybody as citizens and producing products for everybody. So I'm going to vote no, and obviously very disappointed in what we're sending to council, because council has no urgency, nothing to make any changes to RIP in any shape, way, or form.
That was Andre Bau of Portland's Planning and Sustainability Commission. Mayor Wheeler's residential infill project is a simple continuation of Portland's history of institutional racism. If implemented, the plan would ramp up the displacement of minorities and make Portland that much whiter. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller delivered his long-awaited report today to Attorney General William Barr. But now the question is, how much of it will the public see? The investigation into President Donald Trump's presidential campaign's alleged collusion with the Russian government has consumed Trump, who has called the Mueller probe a witch hunt numerous times. So far, a half dozen former Trump aides have been indicted or convicted of crimes, mainly for lying to federal investigators or Congress. Mueller was appointed in May of 2017, and he and his team have focused on how Russian operatives sought to sway the 2016 presidential election and whether Trump or anyone tied to his campaign, either knowingly or unknowingly, cooperated with them. While there is a lot of pressure, especially from congressional Democrats, for Attorney General Barr to release the full report, Justice Department policy states that prosecutors should generally not talk about people who have been investigated but not charged. During Barr's confirmation hearings, Democrats pressed Barr to say he would release the full Mueller report. He did not agree to do so. If the full report is not released, Democrats could subpoena the report and have Mueller testify to Congress.
While some major art institutions are standing up to the OxyContin-producing Sackler family, a key question is whether others will join in and what will happen to all those buildings carrying the Sackler name. The family owns Purdue Pharma, the drug company behind the opioid that has addicted hundreds of thousands and resulted in the nation's worst drug epidemic. London's National Portrait Gallery announced Tuesday that it would not accept $1.3 million for a public engagement project. On Thursday, the prestigious Tate Art Gallery, with locations in London, Liverpool, and Cornwall, said it too would not take Sackler money. Locally, in January, the University of Washington quietly eliminated mention of a Sackler-funded postdoc biophysics program from its website. But the Sackler name remains on key art institutions around the world, and it remains to be seen what will happen to all of those engraved walls. The years 2016 and 2017 marked the first decline in life expectancy in the United States since the influenza outbreak of 1915. This is due in large part to the opioid crisis.
The city of Amsterdam in the Netherlands has banned guided tours of the red light district, alongside many other measures to manage tourism. The Amsterdam red light district is one of the most famous in the world, famous for its sex workers who pose in windows and attract large crowds that take their pictures. The New York Times reports that this type of tourism and its effects on the actual sex industry, quote, had a negative effect on their business. The new law announced Wednesday included requiring guides to earn certification, limiting the numbers of participants allowed in each group, and additional tax for tour participants. Dutch authorities hope the measure will improve conditions for sex workers and prevent overcrowding. The new law goes into effect January 1st.
The ExxonMobil Corporation skipped a hearing at the European Parliament yesterday about whether it knowingly lied and spread disinformation about climate change. In response, a Green member of Parliament introduced a resolution banning the oil giant from doing business in the European Union. If it succeeds, ExxonMobil would join the Monsanto Corporation in being prohibited from lobbying at the EU. Monsanto was penalized in 2017 for failing to show up at a hearing investigating if the company lied about whether the pesticide Roundup causes cancer. Evidence introduced in the European Parliament hearing yesterday showed that Exxon has known that burning fossil fuels would generate global warming since 1959. Harvard University researcher Jeffrey Supran told reporters that he found evidence in corporate documents showing that they knew, quote, that they knew it was, quote, sufficient to melt the ice cap and submerge New York, end quote. Supran introduced into the hearing a study he co-wrote based on hundreds of company documents generated over a period of decades. He found that four-fifths of Exxon's internal documents acknowledged the science behind climate change, while a similar percentage of their paid newspaper editorials in the United States cast doubt on it.
Just a week after a white supremacist terrorist gunned down 50 worshippers in two New Zealand mosques, hundreds of people formed a human chain around a mosque in Wellington, the Kiwi capital. Last week's killings took place in Christchurch on the South Island. Today, a newspaper there called the Press ran the Arabic word for peace, Salam, on its front page. The word was written in Arabic. Photos of the human chain showed many women in headscarves as a sign of support for the Muslim community. Members of the Muslim community offered water and sunscreen to those participating in the event. The show of unity comes a day after Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced that the country will ban all military-style semi-automatic assault weapons.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 22nd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Asia Hawthorne, Ray Bodwell, Joe Meyer, Leslie McClam, and Miriam Widman. Our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Hey, we need more news. We need more news. We need that as well. But we need more news volunteers. Find out how to be part of this broadcast. Come and join us by emailing lisa@kboo.org. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Grace Sand-Smith. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, host Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey take your calls. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Locus Focus host Barbara Bernstein welcomes Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. At 11, Food Sleuth Radio talks to Dr. Todd Cooperman about the differences between hemp oil and CBD oil, cannabinoid oil and cannabinoids, and discusses the difference in doses found in CBD oil prescribed as a drug to treat epilepsy. Then at 11:30, it's Voice for the Animals host Courtney Scott interviews Amber Canavan of Compassionate PDX, who will inform us about a plan to ban the sale of fur here in Portland. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion on Tuesday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at City Hall in Portland. The community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion will address the realities of climate breakdown and the expansion of fossil fuels infrastructure. The event will pose questions about oil train traffic along the Columbia River,